This is just a quick introduction to the podcast, just to let you know that I split it into two. That wasn't my plan when we got started, but we ran a bit long. And as you'll find out, if you listen to the end, there was sort of a natural break. So I took advantage of that. Anyway, let's go. Hello, and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hogg. My guest today is Anthony Kaldelis. Anthony is Professor of Classics at the University of Chicago and is a leading authority on the Eastern Roman Empire. He's written many books on the subject, some aimed at academics and others at a more general reader. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book, which is called The New Roman Empire, A History of Byzantium. And this is an absolutely magisterial account of the Eastern Empire, right from the founding of Constantinople in 324 AD, all the way to the last siege and the fall of the city to the Ottomans in 1453. So welcome, Anthony, to the podcast.
Thank you, Russell, for having me on.
So one thing I wanted to clear up before we get going, which is what terms we should use to refer to our subject, because the subtitle of your book is A History of Byzantium. And for me, at least, the term Byzantium and calling the people Byzantines is actually quite useful because it makes it clear what period we're talking about and what part of the world. But apart from that sort of front cover of your book, you really don't use the term. So what's the issue here?
So you're exactly right. I think the term Byzantine, Byzantium, and the Byzantines, those are terms that are best used in order to identify the field from a distance. Just to make very broad distinctions between like ancient Rome and this medieval Eastern Roman Empire. But they should not be used as substantives when we're actually doing a narrative or analysis of the society in question. So I avoid using those terms in the book because I don't think that they existed in the way in which especially modern Western historiography has imagined them. I use the terms that are used in our sources, which are Romans and Romania and the Roman polity and so forth. So I use the term in the subtitle so that people who see the book can know roughly what it's about. But beyond that very broad initial point, I don't think there's any reason to use these terms. They're very distorting. They have been used for political reasons to misinterpret this polity and its society. And even when that's not done deliberately, they still mislead in ways that I think we can do better. Your audience should keep in mind that these terms were sort of invented in the way in which they're used today in the late 19th century. They're not particularly old. I mean, they're old words, but they meant something very different at the time. So Byzantium is just an archaizing name for the city of Constantinople. The Byzantines were only the inhabitants of that city. So it's modern historians who have used those terms to refer to the empire as a whole and all of its population, but it's a very misleading usage.
Okay, so, well, I'll do my best to try and avoid.
No. So don't worry about it. The field is in the midst of a transition. We're debating these issues right now. There's not like a clear consensus or an alternative has emerged yet. So, you know, no one's shaming anyone for using older terms or newer terms, but just use whatever feels normal to you and eventually things will change or not. We'll see.
Okay. One thing I was curious about quite early on in your book is that the one thing I thought I knew about the Eastern Empire, I think this is right, is that it's a Christian empire. You know, right from the start, Constantine famously converts. Well, he sort of converts, even if he hedges his bets a little bit. But from then on, the empire is set on a path to Christianity. But in the book, you seem to be saying that Christianity doesn't really change the character of the Roman state. Have I got that right? And what's your thinking here?
Yeah, you did get that right. Now, it's true to say that this is a Christian empire, at least a Christian state. I think it's more problematic whether it's an empire or not. That's a different matter. But Christian it certainly was, or understood itself to be that way. At least, let's say, once the majority of the population have converted, so maybe a century after Constantine. But there's a real historical question about what what impact Christianity actually does have. And if you look at the economy, the social structure, the way the political sphere operates, the way the armies work and their goals and their mission and what they do, and none of that is affected by Christianity. At most, they'll replace references to the gods with reference to God. They'll swap out symbols of the gods for symbols of Christ and carry on as before. So there's no deep-seated structural change, at least not for a very long time. What you have is people stop going to temples and they start going to churches. But that's a given. With when you say this is a Christian society, that is what that means. But it doesn't go much further than that. You have some people who take the Christian message very seriously, and they devote themselves to lives of prayer or asceticism, and you have monasticism emerge. And that's real. That's a real social impact. But overall, in terms of the demography, these are smaller groups. And again, they don't impact the way that society operates. Much later, you know, by the middle Byzantine period, you start to see a more visible impact on social values. We can talk about those, but again, very little influence on, you know, socioeconomic, political, military history, very little still.
I was quite interested in the transition. I think you made the point that in a way, it's quite easy to transition from pagan to Christian, because all they have to do is cut off the money. And once you cut off the money, the festivals disappear, the temples fall into disrepair. And, you know, in 100 years or so, there's basically nothing left of the pagans.
Yes. So Constantine and his successors redirected a lot of the money from temples and festivals and cities to the central state, for one thing. In other words, we're dealing in a period that has a bigger government. It has a bigger footprint, right, on the ground. It's doing more things. It has a larger bureaucratic apparatus. And so it requires more funds. And in order to acquire those funds, among other things, Constantine and his successors confiscated a great deal of temple wealth, both land and, you know, movable property. Among other things that they used that money with was to build Constantinople and to finance the church. So as a kind of state institution, which received often very generous subsidies and tax breaks from the state, as had priests and temples before that. In other words, it's just kind of slotted into a pre-existing place in the overall organization of the state and society. And deprived of those funds, the old organization of religious cult just couldn't carry on, really. I mean, there were other things happening as well, but that was one factor, yes.
So I thought what we might do is we might sort of look at some general questions and we might look at some more specific historical events. I can't go through all the events of the empire over 1,000 years, but I just wanted to sort of dot in and out of some of the key ones. And I thought one of the obvious first ones was when the Romans lose the Battle of Adrianople to the Goths in I think it was 378. And maybe I'm overstating it and I'd be interested, but I thought that things are going not too bad for the Romans. But then after that, it's all downhill. So I'm kind of interested in your view about that. But I'm also curious, the battle happens in the Eastern Empire. It's the Eastern army that is destroyed, and yet it's the Western part of the empire that seems to suffer from the Goths in the way the Eastern part doesn't. So I just wondered if I sort of got that right.
Yes, that's a very good question. And the narratives of the fall of the Roman Empire, by which we mean the Western Roman Empire, because the Eastern one didn't fall until much, much later, they do have this weird trajectory where they kind of start with the Battle of Adrianople, which happens in the Balkans, not far from Constantinople. And then the narrative somehow continues in the West, and that's where like all the damage happens. And this is because of contingent events. So you're exactly right. The Battle of Adrianople is a major defeat. The Eastern field armies wiped out, thousands of widows grieving, you know, just authors just pulling their hair out in despair about what's going to happen. You know, the lands of the Romans soaked in blood and so forth. Yes. Now, what happened was that the West bore the brunt of that because, for a number of reasons, the Gothic problem was relatively contained afterwards. There was a war with the Goths that resulted in a kind of accommodation, a peace treaty, but it was on terms that the Romans made unusual concessions that they normally didn't with their enemies, which allowed for the existence of a quasi-autonomous sort of Gothic presence in the Balkans. But it contained the immediate problem. And what happened after that is the Goths, these Gothic armies that sort of coalesced around their leaders, long term, they realized that there wasn't much that they could extract from the Eastern Empire in the Balkans, which was a relatively poor area. They had been assigned to live in the relatively poorest part of it. Constantinople was very well fortified. So were the other cities in the area. There were, you know, Romans were investing in the fortifications at this time. So the Goths could go out and plunder and raid, but they couldn't quite, you know, make much progress in terms of securing salaries, concessions, you know, payments, lands, these kinds of things. I'm going to make a very complicated story simple here. They eventually just emigrated to Italy, which is a much nicer land of central Italy. If you know you're an army looking for a sweet deal from the Western emperors. Now, here's the thing: neither the Eastern nor the Western emperors were really willing to deal with them, with the Goths. The deal with them in terms of give them what they wanted. They were treated as grudgingly as undesirables, whom you had to appease somewhat because they were a large army, they were dangerous, but for various reasons, the Romans were not too keen on making concessions to them or further concessions. And so the Goths just kind of wandered around for a while, trying to extract concessions around Italy, and then eventually they moved into Gaul. Where they settled down, and eventually there was a settlement in 418 where they were given some very choice parts of what is today southern France. Okay, so that process was the history of the Goths trying to find a place to live in the Roman Empire, and for various contingent reasons, it ended up being in the West. Had the Eastern Empire not been divided by the Bosporus, this body of water that was controlled by Constantinople, which was very, very fortified, they might have wandered over into the East. Later Goths tried to do that. Other people tried to do that. But it's just a feature of the geographical situation of the Eastern Roman Empire that these bodies of water, right, from the Aegean, the Sea of Marmara, the Bosporus, and the Black Sea, separate Europe from Asia. And so the authorities can contain problems. If you have a problem on one side, you can prevent it from crossing over to the other, because Constantinople is this bunker fortified city right at the crossing point. And if you have a fleet, which the Romans did and the Goths did not, you can control who gets to cross. So that kicked off a process whereby these barbarian armies that were wanting to enter the Roman Empire at this time ended up settling more in the Western provinces than the Eastern provinces. And so you have the Goths, and then you have the Vandals and the Suebi and all kinds of others. And gradually the Western Empire is dismembered. The Eastern Empire recovers. It doesn't face these problems. The Balkans are, you know, ravaged and destroyed every once in a while, but they're not the most productive, economically important parts of the Eastern Empire. Those are Egypt, Syria, Asia Minor. So there are geostrategic reasons for this. The Eastern Empire then embarks on a trajectory of growth and prosperity, which doesn't end until the 6th century. So the Battle of Adrianople didn't affect the East that much. Yes.
Okay, well then let's jump to the 6th century, and let's jump to the reign of Justinian. And he's sometimes called Justinian the Great? And so this is a sort of a slightly simplistic question, but it's one that maybe Tyler Cowen might use. So is Justinian underrated or overrated?
I think a better way to phrase that would be, is Justinian underestimated or overestimated? Not rated, because it is difficult to find people who like Justinian or who admire him, let's say, or who would, without reservations, include him among those sort of great rulers and everything. He's just a very, very mixed bag and a very difficult person and ruler to come to grips with. He certainly had a major impact, so that much is clear. In so many areas of life, from, you know, wars to the law to religion, he definitely intended to put his stamp on his age. And he was, as one historian put it, he was over aware of living in the age of Justinian. So he did try to change very many things in accordance with his principles and ambitions. And in some areas he succeeded, and in some he did not. He did some positive things, built Hagia Sophia, for example, codified Roman law, passed certain laws that were, you know, overall, I mean, you look at them and this makes sense. But at the same time, he caused so much destruction for so many people through his religious intolerance, his persecution of religious dissidents, many of the wars which were either destructive or pointless or both. So it's a real mixed bag. Plus, you have the plague happening at the time. Now, that's the one thing that he wasn't responsible for, couldn't understand, and couldn't do much about. But it happened then, and it had a pretty major impact.
I wanted to ask you about that because I had Kyle Harper on the podcast a year or so back. I can't remember exactly when, and we talked about this. And my sense was that he felt that this was an event on the scale of the Black Death.
Yes.
But I get the sense that there's different views on this, and there seem to be minimalists and maximalists. And I'm wondering where you stand on this. I don't know if it's a heated academic battle.
It is.
Oh, good.
Yes, it is. So the way I put it in the book is that there are maximalists and there are, let's say, moderates. I don't think there are any minimalists. Everyone agrees that the plague was a terrible event for people who lived through it. It killed very, very many people, and we're agreed on that. But there's a real difference between, let's say, killing off 50% of the population, which is what Kyle says in the book and implies in the graphs that he provides and so forth, and say, guessing that it might have been closer to 10 or 15%. Right? I can't bring myself to imagine that history could have happened the way it did with a 50% loss. It just, everything would have just ground to a halt. And it doesn't. All of the activities of the state and society and economy and the armies and everything just continue on as before, except under a little bit more stress. You can see the stress. You can see stress in the finances, you can see stress in recruitment, but you don't see anything of the kind of catastrophic changes that would have been caused by a 50% mortality. So if you read histories of the Black Death in the 14th century, that does seem to be a much more catastrophic event for people who went through it, but also for the states and societies that experienced it. They just had to stop what they were doing and regroup and try to rebuild. This does not happen in the 6th century. So there is a debate about this, yes.
Okay. So, well, okay, there's another sort of slightly general question. Aside from this, what are the things you think that other historians tend to get wrong about, well, the Byzantine Empire? Is there some area that you think that the consensus is wrong?
A good part of my academic career, as a publishing at least, has been pointing out some of those things. And I rely on some of my past work in this history, not too much, though. In other words, if if folks were expecting that I would have made this history the kind of narrative showcase for my previous theories, it's not that. Those theories have their place. They are in specialized books there. And here I try to put things more into perspective, where the theses that I pointed out in prior books have their place in here, but it is only a place. It's not like a new paradigm necessarily that changes everything. So in the past, I have disagreed with the consensus in my field about questions of ethnicity and identity. We were talking about some of those earlier. Mm-hmm. My field had a major blind spot when it came to ethnicity and was refusing, head stuck in the sand, refusing to discuss the topic at all for very ideological reasons that we can talk about. But I think that I hope now that I've managed to unplug that discussion and it can flow. I also have called out the rather uncritical acceptance of court models of imperial authority, that is, ideas about imperial power that are projected from the court that are mostly theological rather than what emerges from the actual history, like what you find in more historical sources. And so I have called out the uncritical acceptance of theological premises for studying the civilization. And
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you just said.
Okay, good. Thank you. There was a certain type of discourse, let's just call it propaganda for this sake of making it easier for the audience to understand, where the court would say, the emperor is appointed to rule by God, is favored by God, is crowned by God, you know, and I am designated by God to rule over the empire and to, you know, whatever, whatever. And for a long time, my field took that at face value, that, oh, this is what people believed, and turned that into a kind of sociology of power. In other words, so that's why people consented to the imperial regime. That's why they paid their taxes and all that. That is pure BS. It's 100% BS. The emperor was, in fact, emperors were all in a very vulnerable and almost precarious situation sometimes because there was no law of succession. There was no right to the throne, right? Whether by dynastic succession, family, social status, or anything like that. And so at any time, emperors could be challenged by usurpers, as had been the case in the earlier Roman Empire. And they were challenged very often. There's something like 110 civil wars in Byzantium, which are simply, now we say civil wars, this isn't like the English Civil War. This isn't, or the American Civil War. They're not like that. They're much more like violent political campaigns. And they're usually over very quickly. Usually they don't have many casualties. Sometimes they do. Usually they don't. They're entirely about who's in charge. They're not ideological. It's not about changing any kind of system of power or ideology of power or big issue like slavery or parliament versus the king or anything like that. They're just about who's the better person to have in charge and can you muster enough support to challenge an emperor who's unpopular. So emperors are always kind of defensive about this and insecure about it. And they're always looking over their shoulder. And the actual history of East Roman politics is that's the dynamic. It's emperors trying to be popular enough that they're not challenged, but institutionally secure enough to have the armies or enough of public opinion on their side when they are. And one of the instruments that they use to kind of protect themselves ideologically is this imperial idea of, you know, God favors me, God favors me. Yes, God favors you until the moment he doesn't. And they all understood that. And the moment he doesn't and there's a usurper and that usurper looks, you know, is more popular, God's not going to step in. Like they knew this. So that was an attempt to ameliorate the vulnerability of the emperor. And so it's a kind of defensive ideological mechanism. But my field, for a very long time, and again for ideological reasons of its own, was treating this as some kind of bedrock foundational doctrine that everybody accepted, and that we must understand East Roman politics, quote, Byzantine politics, as centered on that idea, right? I don't think that's right. It was much more complex. It was part of the picture, but it wasn't the foundation of the political order. So those are some of the things that I've called out. In this book, I would say that if this book has, I'll mention one idea that is sort of pervasive throughout the book, which in a certain sense diverges from the general consensus. It's that the state made insistent and numerous frequent proclamations that its existence was to serve its subjects, the public interest. And my conclusion is that by and large, those were sincere. Not that there's not corruption or self-serving or greedy elites or whatever, but by and large, it did follow through on those promises in ways that its subjects could see. So in very dangerous times, they understood that their taxes were being paid to the state to hire soldiers locally to defend them against foreign enemies, sometimes infidel enemies, whom they did not want to be attacked by, far less ruled by. And so there was a great deal of consensus and consent to the operation of the state, however coercive it might have appeared in the moment. And so I don't see this as a case of just out-and-out exploitation. Like there's these distant elites in Constantinople who have no connection to the provinces and they're just sucking up all of the wealth. No, it's exactly the opposite. The elites in Constantinople are drawn from the provinces. Look at Justinian's inner circle, his top elites. Only one of them was from Constantinople, and that was his wife, Theodora, who was not an elite before he married her. Right? No, these are provincial notables who are drawn up into the imperial system and who always retain links to the provinces. And insofar as they were acting as public officials, they sufficiently retained a sense of responsibility toward their subjects in that regard. Sufficiently. Now, this is not perfect, but it was enough to secure consensus and consent for a long time. And this is in part why the state lasted for so long.
Okay, so let's go back into sort of specific history. So we're into the 600s, and there's this huge war between the Romans and the Persians. And I had James Howard Johnson on the podcast, and he calls it the last great war of antiquity. I don't know if that's his phrase or whether I thought it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But rather than talk about the war, can we just talk a little bit about the Arab invasions that follow after? And that's 634. So Muhammad has died just a few years ago, just a couple of years previously.
Yeah.
And the Arabs come bursting out of, well, they come bursting out of Arabia, I guess. And in just a few years, a decade or two, they've taken the whole of Roman Egypt. They've taken Syria. They've taken Palestine. They eventually take Africa. More to the point, they take the whole Persian Empire. And I just don't understand how this is possible. And I know that everyone says the Romans and the Persians are exhausted from this long war, but the Persians the Romans had their tails up. They had just, been victorious with their super trained army. The Persians still had armies that really hadn't fought. And these empires have lasted for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. What's going on here?
Well, you're not the first person to ask these questions. And there's a certain level at which there's never going to be an answer that will satisfy you if you put it in those terms, in part because this is one of the worst documented periods of East Roman history or even Mesopotamian history. The non-Muslim sources for the conquests are very, very few and meager, though sometimes they have the advantage of being contemporary. But they're just scraps. Whereas the Muslim sources are much, much later and embellished and elaborated with, you know, all of the gaps filled in, and they're just not really reliable. It's difficult to know which reports to trust. That's the thing. We're all sure that there are a lot of very reliable reports in there, but it's just very difficult to pick them out from the later elaborations. So it's very poorly documented. However, I'll say this, that the Roman Empire never had any reason to fortify and defend the frontier that looked toward Arabia. It wasn't a high strategic priority. The most that could ever come out of there, that had ever come out of there, were some minor raiding, cattle rustling, basically, or taking captive some locals and take them off into slavery. But it's not something that required the buildup of a major military presence there. So it's not just the exhaustion of the war with Persia. By the way, the Romans did not come out of that war with all of their armies. I don't know how you put it, but.
Well, the Persian armies were not too bad shape, but the Roman army, at least it was a winning army at the end.
Oh, the Persian armies were in shambles.
I thought they had an army which hadn't even been tested yet. Oh, I don't want to get into the detail because I don't know it well enough to sort of dispute.
They might have, but they, even after losing the war with Rome, they had then engaged in a series of civil wars among each other.
Okay.
And they are also facing an enemy who is coming from a direction that they had never thought to secure. In other words, even if you think about it in terms of a military defense, both empires rely a lot on fortifications that, and just not to get too technical, but they function in a certain way in blocking the progress of invading armies. And they just didn't have those kinds of fortifications there. They'd never needed them. Their armies were oriented in different directions. Both the Heraclius and the Shah were facing major financial problems, so they're not about to just start recruiting. The major threat to each other had lapsed with the end of the war, and so they wanted to reduce expenses, not ramp them up. Also, it seems that the Arabs had managed to put together an army that was, estimates. There's some good estimates. Fred Donner has estimated their total forces at operating against Rome at about 24,000 or something like that. Very mobile. That is the size of a very large Roman field army. A Roman field army at this time might have ideally something like 19,000, 20,000 soldiers, but Heraclius's had been worn down. I'm estimating that Heraclius had something like 1.5 armies, but stretched out from Armenia all the way down to, Palestine. And the Arabs managed to defeat individual units that were scattered here and there. And so by the time that Heraclius managed to put together a large army, this was the Battle of the Yarmouk in 636, it just came down to a battle, and they lost that battle. So one answer to your question would be, well, they lost a decisive battle when it came to it.
Yeah, it could have been different, but it wasn't.
Could have gone differently, definitely. Yeah.
And one thing I was slightly surprised at in your book is that I think you say that the Christians in the lands which are kind of disputed over time between the Arabs and the Romans, I had heard that because of the religious divisions within the empire, that some of the citizens actually preferred Arab rule because they weren't persecuted for their religious beliefs. But I think you say, no, that's not quite right.
And there I'm reflecting what seems to be the consensus among historians on this point, that religious differences among Christians did not ever lead any of them to prefer to be ruled by Muslims. That there's just no good proof for that. You see, for a long time, historians had relied on these much later narratives that were written under Arab rule, which imply that that, in other words, that, oh, you know, our communities helped you guys out when you invaded the Roman Empire. But the problem is that the rights of a particular city or even community or group under Muslim rule is largely dependent on the narrative of its surrender to the Muslim armies. So if you resisted to the end, you got the worst terms. But if you welcomed the Muslim invaders with open arms, then you got the best terms. So long term, these communities have an interest in rewriting the history of their first encounter with the Muslims to make it the most favorable for themselves as possible. So there's a built-in bias in pitching the sources that way, and which is in fact what we see. We can even see cases where we know there was resistance, but over time that narrative gets rewritten to be one of welcoming the Arabs with open arms, because that then retroactively secures them better terms. So you can't trust those sources. And if you can't trust those sources, we have none that support the narrative of welcoming the invaders. That just didn't happen. The only case where that's possible is not in the Arab invasion, but within the Persian War. It appears that there were some Jewish communities in Syria, Palestine, that supported the Persian invaders. This is in the 910s, so a generation earlier. And there's evidence that they did that. And, you know, they made their own decisions about that. That's fine.
The 610s.
Yes, I'm sorry. What did I say? Yeah, the 610s. But not during the Arab-Muslim invasions. There are no stories about Jewish groups that welcomed them then. Again, a very undocumented period from our standpoint.
So talking about religious division, I want to talk about the division between the Eastern Empire and the papacy. And I want to come back to it later when we come to the Fourth Crusade. But is it worth foreshadowing just a bit? What is the nature of the sort of slightly poisonous dispute between the papacy in the West and the emperor and the Eastern Church?
Yeah, so many historians, especially historians of Christianity, will have you believe that the real differences between the Church of Rome and the Church of Constantinople, or what today we will call Catholic and Orthodox, and I'll use those terms just for the sake of convention so that people know what we're talking about, even though those terms weren't used at the time to distinguish between the churches. They would have you believe that this really starts in the either the 9th century or the 11th century or somewhere in between there. In fact, I believe it goes back to the very beginning of the Christian, of the imperial church, either under Constantine or very soon after. And it has to do specifically with the very different views about the organization of the church that were held in Rome and in the East. So Rome develops a theory according to which the Bishop of Rome, or the Pope, is the supreme head of the church, far above any other bishop, not only in terms of just prestige, but also certain kinds of institutional authority. So at first, this was the right to be the arbiter of basically any other dispute in the church, specifically regarding personnel. In other words, if a bishop is deposed anywhere in the Christian world, he has the right to appeal to the Pope to initiate a process whereby the Church of Rome and its own, you know, instruments, councils, synods, whatever, will have the final word. And eventually, Rome extends that right of supervision to deciding on even theological matters and whatever. So the rhetoric that comes out of Rome, not just the rhetoric, but the sort of ideological position, is that the See of St. Peter is the ultimate authority in the church, the final arbiter of any disagreement. This position was never accepted in the East. In the East, Rome was regarded as a church of high honor that was first in terms of like its prestige, But that didn't translate into any kind of institutional authority, far less a kind of monarchical position over the church. Instead, the view was that matters that affected more than one sort of region, let's say, of the church should be decided by a council. And the councils are convened by the emperors. So when a problem gets so big that it's affecting the whole Christian world, the emperor needs to convene an ecumenical council with representatives from all of the churches who will meet and decide and resolve the issue. And now, of course, this is obviously very difficult to organize. The emperors did that because there were always problems, like who do you invite? You can gain the representation to get exactly the results that you want, and all of the emperors did that. So the major councils of the church were held in the East, not the West. And the Church of Rome recognizes them, though sometimes grudgingly, so very grudgingly, because those councils do not enshrine this kind of apostolic supremacy of the Church of Rome. They defer to Rome as a sort of place of honor, but otherwise all of the bishops collaborate and resolve the issues or whatever it happens to be. And those councils also elevated Constantinople to a position sort of equal to that of Rome, or nominally equal to that of Rome, though second to it in honor. And Rome never liked that at all, and sometimes even refused to ratify councils that otherwise enshrined its positions, because those councils also elevated Constantinople to this higher rank. Anyway, so there's, right from the start, there's the potential for tension and dispute and conflict, because Rome will just periodically not recognize something that happened in the East.
And it's fundamentally staking out a position which the East simply can't accept, right? I mean, there's no way they can accept effectively rule from Rome.
Yes, rule of the church, yes. And so periodically, from very early on, you will have schisms. That is, when two churches, let's just say, they're not talking to each other. Like, they're not disagreeing over theology or belief or whatever, but they're just like, yeah, they're having a bad day. But these bad days sometimes last 30 years. And this happens on and again and again and again. So even in the early period, about a third of the years, I don't know, I calculated it somewhere, I don't know, maybe it's a third or something like that, are periods when the two churches are in schism. They're not talking to each other. They're not like recognizing each other, or they're... And so even later, when you start having actual or at least they believe there were actual theological differences, like the procession of the Holy Spirit is a major topic, or the kind of bread that you use in the Eucharist, or whatever. On the one hand, they disagree about those issues. You know, what is it the proper Christian should do or believe? But anytime you push on those issues, you will always arrive at the deeper issue, which is who gets to resolve, how do we resolve the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the problems are one problem. The problem of not being able to solve the problems is the bigger problem.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
And this one just turns out to be completely intractable. And still, to this day, the two churches, while nominally in union, so nominally they had union in the 15th century, then they kind of, quote, forgot about it, and then they had union again in the 1960s, they still don't see eye to eye about this, and therefore can never have any meaningful joint action, because they don't recognize each other's leadership structures.
And I guess there's a lot of prejudice against the Byzantines in the West, and that's true then, more so and more so and more so over time, and it's now as well, perhaps, that, you know, the way we look, you were saying earlier, the way we've sort of been encouraged to see them. But they did behave quite disgracefully in some ways, and one thing I have in mind is that they allowed women to rule. What? So was the way the West viewed women rulers, was that very different to Byzantium, or is it just that it so happened that they were that there were powerful rulers in Byzantium because Byzantium had powerful rulers?
Well, I don't think the differences were that significant. And even Western countries, Western Christian kingdoms, at one time or another came around to the idea of a woman being in charge, at least for a while. I mean, even think of it, I mean, in English history, you have Elizabeth I, who managed to pull it off successfully.
But that's late. That's very late.
It is late, yes. But here's the thing, though. The Eastern Roman Empire is way, way ahead of its Western counterparts as a Christian country, in part because it never had to rebuild its relationship with, like, Roman law, or, you know, having a common system of law for all people and for all of its citizens and so forth. For that matter, let me this is a take time out here really quickly and point out that there's a narrative about the emergence of the modern state that is so limited to Western Europe, right? So not only the idea of the sort of nation state, but also of an actual proper state that can, for example, tax all of its citizens and recruit a national army, that happens so late in Western Christian countries, really like sometimes maybe 18th century. That's all standard in the Eastern Roman Empire. That's the default. That's just how it's done, and it's how it's always done. The land was surveyed. It was taxed. I'm going to say fairly. That means it's a flat tax. Everybody pays the same. There's a lot of variation, obviously, in terms of what you pay to the state, but there was an attempt to sort of equalize it. Now, of course, today we think of flat taxes as regressive, but by ancient standards, they're very fair. Also, it recruited its army from the entire population of its territory in order to protect the entirety of the territory. So it functions essentially as a national army. It has a single law of citizenship. The law of citizenship is that anyone born within the Roman state is a Roman citizen.
So this is why you're saying it's not an empire, right, earlier on?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons, yes. It's also a majority ethnic Roman state, which is another reason. But that's a different matter. So all of these things would have just been fantasy in the West. And how does this affect women? Well, it's not that women had necessarily, I mean, women didn't have political rights in the Roman tradition. Obviously, they couldn't like hold office or anything like that. However, Roman law, especially imperial Roman law as modified by Justinian and so on, had given them a lot of rights, legal rights, especially when it comes to inheritance. And I remember also that this is not a society in which inheritance is governed by primogeniture, right? So estates, all of the heirs are entitled to a portion of the inheritance. It doesn't all just go to the first son and the rest go find a place in the church or whatever. So this also prevents the buildup of, you know, generations-long noble houses that just get richer and richer and richer, because with every generation, not all the time, they often don't have more than one son, but they get broken up, women get a portion of the inheritance, and so forth. It's also not a society that restricts women in the private public sphere. That sounds weird, but like from private activities in the public sphere, right? So you can't hold offices, sure, but you run businesses, you own property, you handle your own, finances, either when you don't have a husband or in collaboration with your husband sometimes. So they're not banished from the public sphere. They're not, in other words, the religious bearded class that has a problem with women, and there always was, they don't get to cover up the women. It's exactly the opposite. They have to go live in the desert or behind walls. If women are a problem for them, they have to go away. So it's not a society run by the religious extremists at all, right? And women do have a lot of rights and property and power and so on. Now, this doesn't explain how it is that a woman came to rule, but it creates a little bit of the context. And see, again, there's no right to the throne. There's no law of succession. The person holds the throne who's able to do so. And the person who's able to do so is the one who has enough support around him, or in some cases her, to do so effectively. And the first woman who did that was Irene in the late 8th century. And it turns out she actually wasn't that capable, or at least many of her policies failed. She racked up too many failures very quickly, and so was deposed by, you know, a finance minister. And, you know, she was sent off to an island, and he took over.
I actually wanted to mention Princess Irene, because they're always sort of joking about the awful things the Byzantines did, like, you know, women in power. There was something that was slightly sickening reading your book, which is to read about all the blindings. And Irene, actually, she blinds her own son. So what's the story with all the blindings?
So she seized power by blinding her son. This is a very poorly documented period where, after looking at everything that we have, and it's mostly coins and some scraps of fragments of narrative, I've come to the conclusion that we cannot reconstruct what was going on behind the scenes here. I can't see the factions. I can't see what people are thinking, that sometimes they support her son, this Constantine VI, and sometimes her. The back and forth just puzzles me. I just can't tease it out. There's just too much we don't know.
But what about the institution? Sorry, go on.
Yeah. Factions at the court and armies, and I they just don't line up in a way that makes sense. Having said that, her blinding of her son in order to seize power, which was the end of a very long power struggle between the two, was obviously shocking to people then, and it tarnished her memory and reputation ever since. So it's not like the society at large was okay with that. It was an extreme version of something that was done usually in order to disqualify people from holding the throne. Now, if you want the deal with the blinding, I would recommend that you speak with Jake Ransohoff, his dissertation was on this, and he's preparing a major new book on blinding in Byzantium, where he kind of explains what all of the dynamics were. So maybe when that's out, you can have him on. But traditionally, it was seen as more compassionate than killing them.
Right.
Right. And I'm not going to have an opinion about whether that's really the case, but, you know, it is a way of looking at it. And it was not practiced only by the East Romans. I mean, this was done all over the place. Now, it wasn't quite so institutionalized in the West, but in the West, you usually just kill your opponents.
Or if you're an Ottoman, you get garrotted, right? So,
yes. I don't know. It's a sticky topic.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another. I don't know if it's a sticky topic or not. Yeah, I don't think you really talked about this subject in your book so much, and maybe you've talked about it in other books. But I wasn't quite sure what was happening to the institution of slavery.
Yes.
During the long period we're talking about. And then there was another, you do mention them, but it was quite eunuchs under Christian rules. I think you said you couldn't castrate someone and turn them into a eunuch in Roman territory, but not to worry, just buy some in. So I don't know if the two are really related, but I just had jotted down, maybe talk about slavery, maybe talk about eunuchs if we've got time.
So the slavery is the more difficult topic because it's fairly well attested and documented as an institution in the earlier centuries, so down to the 6th century, when we can track slaves in the sources and in society, we can maybe estimate their numbers at something like 15%, but there's a lot of room for error in that estimate. After that, after the 7th century, it is very difficult to find slaves in the record. They exist. We know they do. as a legal category and as a kind of social practice. However, the terminology around them shifts so that it is very difficult to pick them out from, you know, domestic servants you might be employing, or even just your followers, like a retinue of a, you know, some big man in the provinces has followers, domestics. Like, what are they? I mean, they could be anything from, you know, like his badass warriors to his household staff to slaves. This might have to do with, you know, the sources don't want to talk about slavery in sort of quite explicit terms. It's mixed in with all kinds of talk about, you know, slaves of God who are everywhere. So it's going to take a lot more work for us to find these slaves. Now, when we're not talking about things like, you know, foreign captives of war who are resettled on lands, those possibly were enslaved, it's murky. So slavery is a murky thing. It exists. There's a slave trade. Sometimes the slave trade is going through Byzantium. It's not in it, but, you know, they're buying slaves. It then becomes a much, much bigger issue in the late period when a combination of Genoese and Venetian traders and Ottoman conquerors sort of find common ground, and one group is buying and the other group is selling. And so large numbers of people are enslaved and sold off in this period. But in this case, the Romans are the victims of the slave trade, not the slave owners or traders, for example. Anyway, so slavery, we need more work on this. Eunuchs, you're right. Technically, it was illegal to castrate children in Roman territory, but it did happen. We know it happened a lot. And sometimes it could just happen as a, well, they would say for medical reasons, right? And, you know, sometimes for medical reasons, it's necessary. And we have medical textbooks that describe when they thought it was necessary. But more likely, this was a kind of pretext for doing it without incurring legal sanction. They also imported eunuchs from abroad. You're right. So they did that too. And in part, this was because eunuchs had opportunities at the court and in the church. And just as, you know, domestic staff, many were slaves. So the topics of slavery and eunuchs overlap quite a bit. But again, we need more work to know where and how exactly. So eunuchs were very present at the court, at least down to the 11th century, and they were employed as stewards and, you know, household managers, and, you know, you basically entrust them with sensitive business and so forth.
But why do you need a eunuch? Why can't you have somebody who's fully intact doing these roles?
So, I mean, it depends on who you are. In one sense, since eunuchs can't have their own families, their loyalty to you is not compromised by, you know, having their own network to take care of, possibly at the expense of yours, or they're not going to lobby you for their children or their in-laws or whatever. In other words, they are free of the complications of their own families. And since they can't, jeopardize the, you know, whether your heirs are genuine or not, let's say, if you right? So you can entrust them to be around the women folk, especially in sort of very sensitive cases like in the palace, where the legitimacy of an heir is something, you know, the court cares about. So it's easier to entrust the empress and all the ladies in waiting and so forth to a sort of professional group of eunuch stewards and handlers than to, you know, your. I mean, history was just too full of men who seized the throne because they worked their way up through the women's quarters of the palace. This is a way that ancient courts found to block that avenue of ambition.
But I don't see this happening, and maybe this is just ignorance on my part, actually, but I sort of see eunuchs in the Ottoman Empire. I see that in the empires of the East, but I know that people were castrated in the West and then sold off into the, you know, there was, you know, the famous, the famous castration trade in France, I think. But you don't seem to see eunuchs in Western Europe. Now, maybe that's just because I haven't been paying attention.
There are definitely eunuchs in medieval Western Europe. Part of the difference is that they're less visible. And they're less visible because they tend not to occupy as many positions of power as they did, say, in Constantinople. And why do they occupy positions of power in Constantinople? And here's where Roman politics is different from medieval politics. Because remember, eunuchs at the court is something that you find under like the Julio-Claudians already. It's not some Byzantine thing. It's a Roman imperial thing, right? So in the West, let's say, if you want to give a sort of comparative feudal model, kings have very limited power generally. And in order to get anything done, they have to negotiate with their barons or, you know, whatever title they happen to have. And the barons like to, you know, hold all of these positions at court, which signifies their status. So being a very high status feudal lord in the West means holding all these positions at the court, you know, master of horse or, you know, keeper of the falcons or whatever it is, right? In the East, where there's an actual government, the emperors preside over a very large bureaucracy that is relatively impersonal. In other words, the bureaucratic apparatus, you know, carries on regardless of who the emperor is, and it's not dependent on all of these lords who come in. In fact, there's nothing quite like a feudal lord in the Eastern Roman Empire. So the emperors have to make sure. So they have to make sure of a number of things. First of all, that they're not made redundant by their own bureaucracies. In other words, they have to have a way of checking their own bureaucracies because otherwise, you know how bureaucracies work. They just take over all the procedures themselves. And they also have to make sure, what we were talking about earlier, that they not be replaced by ambitious generals or courtiers or politicians or whatever, which they could be in a palace coup or a civil war. So they need to find their own independent ways of checking those groups. And one of the ways that they do that is by using eunuchs. So eunuchs who are, let's say, of servile background or foreign background and have no families. So they're completely dependent on the emperors for their position and their livelihoods. And so emperors will very often endow these eunuchs with extraordinary commands or positions of power in order to use them to check the powers of, say, the administration or the powerful generals or any bearded man, right? So emperors are always playing this kind of juggling game of making sure that they're not made redundant and that no other centers of power emerge that can challenge them. And eunuchs are one of the pieces that they can use in doing that because eunuchs can't take the throne, and they're coming from outside the bureaucratic structures, for example, right? So there you see why eunuchs would be useful to emperors. And many of these eunuchs are very, very capable men. I mean, they're men. They're not some other thing. They're for the most part seen as men, but a special category of them. And they're given military commands. They're put in charge of the church sometimes. They're like, they have real, real power, which is not something that can easily happen in the West because the kings don't really have control over the government, in part because there is no government, right? At least not a regular thing like that. And whatever there is the object of ambition for all of their lords. So the context of politics is different in the East, which is why you have such visibility of eunuchs. But that changes too after the 11th century. Yeah.
I'm just going to do a timeout here. I'm about, I think, three quarters of the way through or two thirds of the way through. I don't know how much more time you're willing to do. If you've got another 40 minutes, that would be great, or 30 minutes, but I don't know if you have. And if you...
I do. 30 to 40 minutes we can do. Give me a second to set out my bread from the freezer.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take a break there. And I'm going to split the podcast. And Anthony and I are actually going to continue here, but I'll split the podcast and we'll start again, you know, in the next installment. Next week, I don't know, next 2 weeks, next 3 weeks, something like that. So this is the end of part one. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll start again with part two, which I hope you'll join us for.